Good evening. My name is Marissa Levine, and I'm the director of InForum here at the Commonwealth Club, and it is a pleasure to have all of you here tonight. Now, I have something we've been starting to do here, which is that I like all of you to get a chance to say hello to each other before we get started, also so you'll stick around and hang out with each other afterwards. So I am setting a time limit. You have 15 seconds. You're all a chatty bunch, and then I'm going to have to rein you in. So turn to your neighbor, especially if you don't know them, and say hi. Tell them why you're here. I think you've all made a friend now. This is the hardest part. Getting you all to come back. We've made too many new friends. New friends, come back to me. Come back to me, new friends. The best part about your new friendship is that during the book signing, you can join us down the hall, have another glass of wine. New friends. Too many new friends. I've created a monster here, but it is more fun when you guys know each other. So take your new friend down the hall after the event, grab a glass of wine, and hang out with us. That's the best part. Tonight, we are thrilled to be hosting Jessica Herron, CEO and founder of Stella & Dot. Who will be in conversation with Jory Desjardins, who is the founder of Blog Her. So I think there's a lot we can all learn tonight, and we're very excited. Now, here at the club, we actually host programs like this 3 to 5 nights a week. That comes up to hundreds of programs a year. But that's only possible because of our community of members, donors, supporters, attendees, volunteers, all of you. So if you would like to find out more about how to get involved, I've got some board members up front who would be happy to talk to you. I've got some staff and volunteers, so stop any of us and ask us how you can get more involved. Coming up at the club and at InForum in June, we've got a ton of things. June 13th, the California Book Awards honoring literature published right here in California. June 14th, Bruce Bochy, manager of the San Francisco Giants. June 16th, Lucy Kalanithi on a book published with her late husband, When Breath Without Air. June 21st, a very young novelist, Emma Klein, on her new book, The Girls. And on June 29th, we're hosting journalists to talk about their planned media blitz covering the homelessness problem here in San Francisco, including the editors of The Chronicle, KQED, and Mother Jones. So, and we're always announcing new programs, so stay tuned. There could be some fun stuff coming up. You can get tickets. We also have a sheet that can let you enter to win free tickets over in the fireside room. Now, we like to live tweet, so I'm not going to tell you to turn your phones off, but I am going to tell you to turn your ringers off because we hate that. So follow us at InForumSF. You could also follow Jory at JoryDJ and Jessica at Jessica Herron. So tag them as you're tweeting tonight. We love pictures, but ringers off, please. Again, after the program, Jessica will be signing this book, this awesome book, which I just finished, down the hall. You can buy copies or bring the copy that you got, and she'll be happy to sign them afterwards. And without any further ado, it is my pleasure to bring Jessica and Jory to the InForum stage.
Ladies first.
Thank you.
Note, I brought my book, my newly signed book, so I can refer to it
when I need to. Hi, and welcome. This was pretty serendipitous for me because when I started my company, Blog Her, in 2005, there was another company, and I want to say was it the same year that you founded Stella & Dot?
Pretty much, 2004. We really got going around 2007.
But I knew who she was. And the point is, I followed her journey, and I kind of kept along with it. And even though we had very different product, mm-hmm. we had digital media, you had product, beautiful jewelry, later skincare line, other products. I still followed it because I felt like we had something very much in common. And what that was is when we started the company, my co-founders and I would meet at Starbucks for about 18 months before we got our first round of funding. We were all in transition. One of us was a single mom with a boy who wanted to do a lot more and not just sit in a corporate environment, but she had to figure out how to make it work. The other one was tired of working the corporate ladder and felt like only she could control her own destiny. And then there was me, who had left and became a little bit addicted to blogging and realized, how do I do this for the rest of my life? And we started Blog Her not because, well, I suppose we were fans of blogging, but because we wanted control of our lives. Mm-hmm. And when I think about why you started Stella and Dot, you basically created the business that enabled you to have the life you wanted. And that business was jewelry at first, but it also was giving people the lives that they want.
Mm-hmm. It was really when I started Stella and Dot, I wasn't going to start an accessories company. It was very much focused on democratizing entrepreneurship. I had been an entrepreneur I dropped out of business school in order to co-found the company that went on to become WeddingChannel.com. And I was very much a go-go-go.com days internet entrepreneur. And it was through that experience that I realized that you could really be commercially successful and yet not truly successful. And if I wanted to think about the next phase of my life, I wanted to define success as happiness. And I wanted a business where I actually ran it instead of it running me. And it was during that time that a lot of women had reached out to me. We'd gotten great press. We were fortunate enough to be featured on Oprah. And I had all these women reach out to me and say, that looks amazing. I want to do what you do. And behind the scenes, you know, it looked good on TV, but in reality, it was actually a nightmare. I was thinking I worked every day, night and weekend for 4 years. And I was doing something where I was proud of the intellectual and commercial accomplishment, but I didn't feel soulfully connected to the mission. And I didn't have a good answer to giving other people business advice. You know, what was I going to say? Go get a specialized education, work night and day, hire employees, get a lease. And so I wanted to come up with a better answer. So it wasn't about jewelry. It was about really saying, there has to be a way, there has to be an answer to this question where how can more people have the joy of entrepreneurship, but yet not have the risk and still be able to do it on their own terms. And that seed was planted years before I actually started the business.
Well, and that's what I appreciate is that you rewrote that narrative. So I don't know how many of you are starting companies or thinking of starting companies or in the middle of a company, but it seems like, especially in this part of the world, that there is a narrative of what that needs to look like. For one thing, you should live in a garage or in a car. You should
be a young engineer, male in a hoodie.
Yeah, right. And you know, I've been advising startups, and I have a female entrepreneur who came to me, and she said, I just got into an incubator. And I said, well, that's great. And she said, no, it's not great. I don't know what I was thinking. I can't pick up and leave my kids. I've got a place. She had to go to New York for 3 months. And it's just not, it doesn't feel accessible. Right? We see the narrative, and you had created your own narrative. Mm-hmm. So how was that the plan?
Well, I think it's one of the reasons why I became convinced that there was something worth writing about in writing Find Your Extraordinary, because I really wrote it as a guide to help other people define success as happiness and create it in their own lives on their own terms. And it's because I think when you look at the company or the business or you read an article in the paper, you assume, oh, here was this straight upwards path to the right. And that's what success looks like. And it must have been always on track and always directed. And the reality is it looks like a 4-year-old got a hold of an Etch-a-Sketch and that's been the path. And I think that that's actually what I discover is the true story behind most impactful things. You know, I started out in life, and in high school, people might have said that is the least likely person to succeed. I was more interested in socializing than studying. I was a moody teen having a bad reaction to growing up with a mother who suffered from mental illness and a very dramatic divorce. And I had a teacher that was very kind enough to call me on it and basically kick me out of her class one day for being sassy. And she said, you're almost late. And I'm like, wait, why are you congratulating me? Because that means on time, almost late, right? And so, but she just wasn't amused because there were many times that I was actually late and unprepared when I got there. And she called and kicked me out. And I thought, what, that's a little harsh, you know, for just being, you know, one remark. And she's like, no, it's not, because you're the biggest waste I've ever seen. And it was a great wake-up call. It was the most loving thing that anyone had ever done to me. And at that moment, I'm like, I think she's right. I am wasting my potential. I am not bringing it. And so I decided to turn it around and crack down. And I went to community college. And at that time, I worked, you know, was paying my way through school. I worked 2 jobs. And when I did get straight A's and I did apply, and I decided I wanted to go to Stanford. And when I went to speak to the counselor, she laughed and said, people like you don't go there. And there's no way. And, you know, this was back when I just met another person from the class of 94. Well, unfortunately, back then, Stanford didn't have a website. It wasn't like you filled out a digital application. So I really needed her to be the conduit for this piece of paper I could fill out to mail in. And so, but she wouldn't get it for me. And I'm like, listen, she's like, doesn't matter if you have straight A's. You're not going there. No one from here would go there. I'm like, listen, lady, if you have such disdain for the students that go here, you should get a different job. I don't want my tax dollars funding you and your bad attitude. Which I loved that I didn't want my $3 I was paying in taxes to like 1/1000th of a cent right. going to her. But it was a great lesson early on in life that you have to be your own biggest source of strength. And even if you are on a path where other people are going to doubt your next step, that you've got to decide what that looks like and that you've got to be the one that in that moment you don't doubt yourself, you doubt the people who doubt you. And I did apply, and I did get in. And even though I was there, I still had that imposter syndrome because a lot of people say, hey, this one doesn't look like the other one. But I think that's what made me strong because by that point, I'd become really resilient. I'd become really used to people saying, hey, probably not you. And that brought up that very early well in me being like, I'm the one. And I think that everyone has this voice in themselves where there's moments in their life where they think to themselves, wait a minute, I think I could be the one. And I think when you feel that, I really do. Have you ever had it? You think like I'm the one. And I think that when you do, you have to listen to it and you have to go for it and work for it. So my path has been anything but ordinary, as an entrepreneur and going to tech and doing all the other crazy choices I've made since then.
So let's talk about your gut. Because there's a consistent theme here. So you get into Stanford, then you go to Stanford and you're like, I think I'm going to take off, start a company before I graduate.
Well, that was undergrad. I went to become into technology and then I went back to business school and then I dropped out of business school.
And then you dropped out of business school. And then you started a company, you sold it and you're like, this is what everyone's supposed to do, but I think I'm going to move to Texas.
Well, that was a very unexpected journey. So first of all, there was a window of time to start the first business that I wanted to start. And it was, I didn't go to business school because I wanted a pedigree or a piece of paper to hang on the wall. I really wanted the knowledge and the connections to become an entrepreneur. So if that happened before the degree happened, I saw it as efficient, not risky. And luckily I was raised by a single dad who felt the same way. I mean, he never felt that you needed to be anointed ready, you know, or pedigreed or by somebody else to go do something. So I didn't have a moment of pause when we got funding when I was in my first year. Dropping out seemed like a no-brainer. So that was good. He was very impressed. He said, getting into Stanford Business School, that's good. But dropping out, he was very...
That's the best.
Then he was very proud. And then that time was such a crazy time in Silicon Valley. It's kind of actually history is somewhat repeating itself, where there's all this froth and there's no rationalization around business model and profitability and all those things. But, and we saw that movie the first time and I actually am very proud that that concept was very valid and strong and we sold the company. But when I was there, I remember feeling really complete, mission complete. And I wasn't in love with the idea of weddings. You know, I love my own, but I didn't want to work in that industry forever. We had wanted to go do something in an industry in aggregate gift registries, and we were enterprise software solution for retailers. And I learned a lot. But at the end, my husband got a job back in Austin, Texas. And I didn't think that I could tell him not to go take his dream job so that I could stay at mine longer when I wasn't even in love with it. And really, at that time, I was working. I was almost 30, which seems incredibly young to me now. But at the time, I thought I was old and I always wanted to be a mother. And I remember sending him an email from my desk late one night because I'd gotten this, you know, chart. I saw a chart online about the declining fertility rates of women as they age. And I just sent him the image and I'm like, and the subject line was my eggs are rotting. And I was very focused on wanting to start a family. And so we moved to Texas and I took a job. I went from being a founder of an internet company to taking a job as a middle manager at Dell Computers in Austin, Texas. And people thought I was crazy. They thought that, why would you do that? Why would you go move out of the heart of the action? But for me, I had already had the idea for starting the company that would become Stella and Dot. And I thought, well, this will be the perfect time. This will be a way. One, a mentor said, hey, if you ever want to work at a large company, run a large company, you should work at one. And that was very, very sound advice. I think without that step, I might have been the founder of this company, but not the CEO of it today. I learned a lot during those years. I worked every night and weekend on my business idea until I had my beautiful first child who's sitting right there.
But even there, the narrative continues because you did not take venture capital.
No,
initially.
I did that as a first-time entrepreneur. And the second time, I wasn't trying to start a business. I was trying to start a mission and a life. I wanted to make a difference on flexibility in the workforce for women. I wanted to change what that entire industry looked like. And I was terrified of that because I thought of anything that I don't like to say the words direct sales. I thought of that as this icky pyramid scheme thing. And frankly, when I dug into the industry, I realized a lot of that was for good reason. And I went to the conference to learn more about this and I looked around and there were all these reasons why I thought I should never start a company in the space. But then when I stepped back and thought about it, I said, well, what do I like about it? Well, not all of it is mission driven, where you're really focused on the profitability and success of that entrepreneur. That's not really the goal of the company. Or two, the product isn't, nobody's doing their best and really trying to innovate and improve on quality and design and experience and customer delight and wow. And none of it is utilizing technology to make it more powerful, more innovative, or completely focused. So is this really where I want to be? And then I realized, well, that's the reason why I have to go do it, not the reason why I couldn't. So even though it seemed like the biggest crazy uphill climb I would take in my life, at the end of the day, I couldn't ignore that I had found my calling. And that's when I knew when I met my husband, like, wow, that's the one. And when I was in this conference by myself in Florida and this old man, I was pregnant at the time, Charlie, you were there too. I was pregnant and I literally, this elderly gentleman who had clearly been drinking a lot by 10 a.m. and was chain smoking started to hit on me. And I was like, sir, can't you see I'm pregnant? As if that was the only thing wrong with that situation.
Right.
But I went to call my husband and say, I want to go home. What am I doing here? This is crazy. And so there are these great deep moments of doubt. But at the end of the day, I just said, if not, you know, now, then when? If not me, then who? This has to exist. It must exist.
So you have this, and it's funny, you talk about this in the book too, at these moments where your gut and where you're just not feeling comfortable. And we always talk about, I just knew. I just felt like the stars aligned and it felt right. And yours is a little bit different because you're like, I'm sitting here going, why am I here? Yes. That's what I should be doing. So talk a bit about that, because I think that when you imagine that when you found the one, the company that you're meant to do and meant to start, that it's supposed to be like the sky opened and I've had this sudden need and this feeling of, you know, I'm in my place of meaning. And I don't think it worked quite that way when we started our company, and certainly not for you.
Well, I think what I love to tell aspiring entrepreneurs is everyone thinks, you know, overnight success is overnight. And I think it takes about 7 to 10 years. Every business idea that I've had, there's been two companies and then three brands within Stella & Dot. And starting each one of those things, the idea percolated for years before the business came to fruition. In fact, Leslie Blodgett, who's our amazing board member, is sitting here, and she joined our board 5 years, prior to us launching skincare, right? So we were working on it for years, and so it's not an overnight kind of thing. It takes being willing to really invest in and want to. So I had to research everything about weddings, and then I had to research everything about starting a home-based business before it came to be. And there are many moments of doubt along that way, but you got to keep having the bad ideas to make them better. But I didn't get venture capital because the second time around, I didn't want to run the business for the quarter. I wanted to run it for the impact. And I didn't want to do it on somebody else's time horizon. I wanted to do it around my young family. And the amazing thing about that was we still became a hyper growth story. It didn't make us less successful. It was more successful. And I paced it around my first daughter. Then I waited to the second daughter to really kick it into high gear. And sometimes when I go to speak at business schools, they say, well, what really was the inflection inflection point of the company. And they're assuming that the answer is going to be access to capital or market forces or a new technology that enabled disruption. And it's generally, well, I was done breastfeeding my second child. And that was why I could travel. And therefore we went from, you know, a million to 3 million to 33 to 100 to and continue to double. And now we're empowering 60,000 independent business owners in six countries across three brands. But it started very slow, very purposefully around my family.
So once you get into that realm, and we were talking about this beforehand, where I found out I was pregnant in the middle of a fundraise, and I remember agonizing with my partners, like, what are we going to say? What are we going to tell them? And, you know, you just don't do that. Well, but here we were, and what we had decided to do is just say, hey, guess what? I'm pregnant, and move on. And nothing happened. We were fine.
Except for the baby came out.
The baby came out a few months later. But I think there's again, part of this narrative. And what I really love about the book is that it debunks all of these things. And when I've been in conversation since I left my company, we were sold at the end of 2014 and I left BlogHer and am now, what's next? I'm talking to a bunch of entrepreneurs, largely women. And there's a lot of things I hear, which is, well, I want the family. And I just don't know if I can do what is required. I just don't know if, and there's always these little, I don't know. And it's not about not thinking that you're competent. It's I know what would be expected if I were to do it this way. And my question to them is, well, do you need to be a unicorn? Do you need to do it this way? And then if you do, why does it have to be that way? Why does it mean that you sacrifice so much? And there's no question. I think you even said you're going to give up something, you know, you're going to give up something in your life, but why does that mean that you can't have family, or why does that mean you can't have things that are special in your life other than your business? How did you manage to navigate that?
Well, I was very fortunate in the sense that my investor in Stella & Dot was also my investor in Wedding Channel. So Doug McKenzie at Radar Partners was originally at Kleiner Perkins. So I went in, I said, I just had a baby. I'm planning on having another one. And we'd worked together before. And he said, if you're in, I'm in. But that's the privilege of a serial entrepreneur, a second time entrepreneur. The first time entrepreneur, I think, has to really hustle and prove themselves and bootstrap. And I chose to do that the second time. But I think in the end, you know, I was confident that I could do it even around my family. And I've come to see that it's really that confidence rather than the obstacle of, everyone always talks about a woman who's like, well, there's working dads too. They're doing it all the time. And I know my husband loves our children just as much as I do. He has working parent guilt, just like I would. And though we both decided to give it up, the reality is it's irrelevant. And if you treat it as such, it won't become a part of that obstacle or conversation. I just had an entrepreneur reach out to me for advice, and she was saying, oh, some people are going to tell me that I'm going to get a lower valuation because I'm a woman versus a man. I'm like, why are you wasting time talking to those people? That's rubbish. Because first of all, that conversation isn't anything to do with how to improve your product, how to get sales distribution. I'm like, you are going to get a lower valuation because you're not focused on the right things. You're too busy thinking about fearful topics rather than executing your plan. So if you just go about creating value, you will reap that in the rewards.
I can back that with my own experience. I remember when we went out for venture funding, and the fact is we were already making some money. We already had those numbers. And I don't think anyone questioned how we would run that business when you can say, oh, and look, we have some numbers here or some performance against it. No one really questions. They just say, okay, keep going. How do we help you keep going? That was really kind of the narrative that I experienced. There's something else you said in your book that I thought was interesting about the lone wolf and being a lone wolf. And yet,
it's a lone eagle.
Lone
wolf has to be very lonely.
I was going to say the lone wolf. Okay, maybe that was my own interpretation of it, because I feel like I'm a reformed lone wolf. And I'd love for you to talk about the distinction there, because I think we always are about, we have to rely on each other and women really need to help each other. But where do you distinguish when you are?
So there's a professor at Stanford Business School, Irv Grossbeck, and one of the ways that he describes an entrepreneur is to call them a lone eagle. And if you look at what a lone eagle does, is they soar high and they nest alone. alone. And the metaphor in entrepreneurship, when I heard that, I really resonated with it, because a lone eagle nesting alone means that you don't look left, right, and for validation for your choices. You're not afraid to go over here on your own. It doesn't mean you're a loner and that you don't care about the opinions of others. It's just in the end, you hear them, you learn from them, but you decide to decide on your own. And that's always been a trait that I think my father helped me cultivate. It's certainly true for him. And it is true for me, meaning when I dropped out of business school, everyone thought that was crazy. I was like, not a big deal. I didn't need them to approve of my decision. And I think that if you are always looking to see who is going to acknowledge your choices, you're going to be really confused. And the sound of your own voice is going to be very quiet. And you won't have that gut that drives you, that confidence that fuels you. So one of the books, parts of the book is talking about, and it starts with this, because there's the framework in the book for getting what you want, but it has to start with a discussion around self-confidence, around the confidence that success is not for somebody else, it is for you, that only you define what success is and only you create it, and that you've got to believe that there are going to be a lot of naysayers, but they don't get to sit in the front row, and you decide where they sit, and you decide who you surround yourself with, and you've got to learn how to be resilient in the moments that you get told that you're crazy or no, because the no's will always, always keep coming, and that lone eagle confidence is critical to start down this entrepreneurial path, yeah. And that path is about passion, doing something you authentically love, path, which is your plan to actualize it and make it real, your positive mind, so that you can truly see opportunity instead of obstacles. And I think that's just fundamental, right, to being an entrepreneur, because you are going to have problems here, problems there, problems everywhere. But you have to be able to, one, look for the window and the door and just walk through it instead of brute forcing over it every time. It's about finding the people that you need and having the productivity and perseverance to be able to get it all done.
So when did you become a guru?
I
gotta say, I was reading this and I was like, you could be Oprah.
You know, I have been making mistakes for a really long time. And the beautiful part of that is when people always ask me, what did you learn from your biggest failure? And I do think it is a glimpse into my Pollyanna mindset, which has served me well. So I'm not going to become a cynic anytime soon, because I don't look at it that way. I'm like, I either won or I learned, but here I go again. You know, so I have been trying really hard for a long time, and I've learned a lot about by doing it right and doing it wrong.
There was an article, and we talked a little bit about this. There was an article maybe 2 years ago, and it was in the Times, and I didn't even know if I wanted to bring it up, because when I read it, this is how I learned so much about you, because it was about how the class of 1994 in Stanford, when you look at all the graduates, and the men went on to do these amazing things, and all the women did fine, not that great. I mean, Jessica Herron did fine, but a lot of other people could have done better. And I remember reading this and going, well, she's amazing, but what a weird message and what a weird article. And I had to ask you about that, because I thought, what did you think about that? Had to have some thoughts about it.
I first looked at the paper and I thought it was the greatest picture ever run on the cover of the New York Times, because it's actually a picture of Charlie, my daughter. I'm like, it's gorgeous. And I read the caption, and it said, Jessica DeLulo Herron, class of 94, the exception. And at first, and I immediately had the same feeling you did, which is it should have been a pinch me life moment. Like, oh my God, I'm on the cover of New York Times. Like, I can't believe it. Look how far we've come, baby. But I was infuriated. And frankly, after reading it, it was one of the reasons why I chose to write the book, to change the narrative on what is the definition of success. It actually went so far as to say there were women that could have gone into technology, but they opted out. They did things like becoming a doctor, or they wanted to save lives, or they wanted to serve their community, or they wanted to go. What happened to the conversation about success where all the yardstick became, how much money did you make in technology? What a bizarre dystopia we would be living in if that was the definition of success. There are so many different definitions of happiness, because there's different people, and you can only be successful if you're pursuing your own goal and your own dream and your own passion. And it made me angry for the women that work in our community that have chosen to work part-time, flex time, doing all these other things. And I wanted to respond in a way where the narrative was really about celebrating the diversity of choices among us. You know, if at the end of the day, you know, I feel like at this point, I love being in my 40s because it's an impress yourself decade. You care about people more, but you care a lot less about what they think of you. So for me personally, I'm like, okay, whatever. But actually for having two daughters, I don't want them to get the messages that you have to do what your mother did, or you have to do this particular career. And if you don't, something must be wrong with you. You must be failing. You must be doing that, because at the end of the day, don't you want your kids to be happy and healthy? And don't we want a diversity of role models so that they can make an individual choice and see that as a valid direction in life? So I did not, while I was, there was a moment of excitement, it quickly diminished into, wow, that we've really jumped the shark on the narrative of what success is.
Right. And I was wondering, what was that feeling of ick? And I think you just perfectly articulated that feeling of ick. So when I think about your story, even you do a great job of saying, oh, and I had my mistakes over here, but hey, I kept going. What were some of those mistakes?
I think the hardest thing I did in business that is a common, you know, there's lots of things around product and productions and people and hires and, you know, calibrating your strategy. But I've come to see that as that's just work. That's how you create value. That's just part of that. That part was actually relatively easy. Not because it was easy, but what I was doing to myself with working mom guilt was a lot harder. And I think that that's why I wanted to end the conversation in the book around gratitude and not guilt, because so many women will beat themselves up. They're masters in guilt, and instead we need to master happy. And women will fret the choices they're not making, and that sucks the joy out of the choices that they are. Constantly thinking, could I be doing more? Should I be doing that? And I felt that way, even though I knew that I was a great mom. And I think someone will vouch for me up here, right? She should be like,
we'll get to her later.
But I grew up with this amazing grandmother. In fact, Stella Dodd is named after my grandmother on my maternal side, but I had another grandmother, Angie, who was amazing. And I talk about her in the book, her story of resilience, because really she had a phenomenal life as a widow and surviving with my father, and how they really were always happy with what they had. But she was traditional. So after I got married, and I would travel to LA, and because Wedding Channel was down there, and we end up here, and my husband was still in business school, so we couldn't move. And I'd go there all the time, and that's where my dad lived with my grandmother. And she could not believe I was traveling, you know, after getting married, or working after getting married. And she goes, Jessica, you be careful. You get pregnant, you not even know the father. And I'm like, first of all, Grandma, I'm sitting next to you. Like, this is very low risk of conception. And she was, you know, in her mind, I think she was watching too much daytime TV with paternity test reveals. But
yes.
That voice was still in my head, that if I'm choosing to work after marriage or travel away from my husband, that I must be doing something wrong. And so I wanted to go work, and my husband knew that he married a worker, all caps, because he married me while I was doing Wedding Channel. And yet when we had children, we did want someone home, you know, with the kids. And so I put a lot of pressure on myself to be super mom. And I almost died alone, and I could do it all island. You know, I felt, we joke about this, that I'm very against party favors. I think they're ridiculous. Like, I just gave you a party. Why would I have to give you a present? It's not your birthday. So I've always thought that was it's ridiculous. But then sure enough, there I go with the party favors. Yes. And then I realized the mom down the street actually hand sewed mermaid tails. And then the next birthday party would look like Pinterest threw up in my living room.
Yes.
You know, so I think that while
Pinterest
I was trying
That's what it's called.
Do all that, and run a company. And finally, I had to go to my family, my husband, and just say, your level of service is being downgraded. You know, we're not doing this crazy business anymore. You know, good is going to be the new great. No one's ever died of having a frozen pizza now and then. And to my husband, you can also take the kids to the doctors. And now he's the most amazing, supportive, super dad. But it took me realizing that I was enabling all this.
Yes.
I was trying to do everything for everybody all the time, because I thought that's what made me a woman. versus recognizing that, no, I have to advocate again for myself. This is what I'm going to, the reverend that married my husband and I said the most profound and beautiful thing about marriage. And we've been together for 21 years, married for 17. And by the way, we found him on the internet. This was not like a spiritual guru, but it ended up being something really profound in our marriage and our
that
lives.
That was a good search.
Yeah, he said, when we were getting married, he's like, marriage is about taking the person's burdens, the other person's burdens, and making them half, and taking their joys and making them double. And it was only when I could say, wait a minute, this is my joy, please double it. And these are my burdens, please make them half, instead of just carrying all the burdens for myself, that my husband was able to do that. And that made all the difference.
Yep. I think there is this tendency to feel like I have to make sure I've got all of this handled in order to deserve this piece of it. And one of the part that I really loved about the book had to do with the Pinterest guilt. But I found it, you were talking about how there are stay-at-home moms and there are working moms, and it's a choice. There are differences, but it's just almost this fact of life that there's this sort of unspoken tension in between. And I saw myself, I had the same thing where I'm on the playground and they're like, oh, this is Olive's mommy. This is the mommy, the mommy who's never around. You could just hear them saying that in the background. And there's always that guilt. So I would,
there is a chapter in the book that, or a section in the book that says, don't be a mother judger. Because the reality is, whether that judgment or tone is real or imagined, it's really coming because you have this self-inflicted guilt or worry. And if you can cultivate your own confidence for your own choices, then you don't have to hear that judgment, or you certainly don't have to respond to it. And you certainly don't have to lob back any other comments that then make that person feel less than and repeat the vicious cycle of women judging each other rather than not being such a harsh critic of yourself and not being such a harsh judge of others, but rather lifting each other up and celebrating the diversity choices amongst us.
Right. So, okay. So we're going to have a Q&A in about 15 minutes. Okay. So think about your questions. I think is that the one mic that we're going to be using? Okay, so just think about it, and then in about 10 minutes we'll go and you can line up and we'll get to the questions. There's also quite a bit on productivity. Oh, yeah. I was impressed.
That's everything.
Yeah. and I was like, wow. I guess you have to think about your own systems, and you don't even realize that it's needed until you're absolutely like in this place of crazy. And I just never really quite documented my own, but I realized I needed to get them. So what were some of the, what changed it for you? I mean, after a while, something's got to give, right?
I think I've always been a high energy person. So I'm someone who's more comfortable in movement than I am at rest. And my sister has said, my sister, it's great to have a sibling who can always just tell it to you straight, right? She's the one who's always told me, don't expect other people to do what you do. You're the one that's weird. And she's like, you relax by doing and other people relax by, well, relaxing. and I just like to be busy. But productivity, when people say things like, I'm just so crazy busy, I couldn't do that, I think to myself, that is the most disempowering statement you could ever say. Why would you ever diminish your own control over your own life by telling yourself that hideous lie? Of course you're not too busy. You must rather admit the truth, which is, I did not choose that. I chose something else instead. Just say it out loud. And if you don't like your choices, then change your choices. But you can never actually say, I'm crazy busy. Therefore, I couldn't do it. You chose something else. And that's if it's exercise, if you're not choosing exercise, if you're not choosing to have dinner with your family because you chose to go out or you chose other emails, it's not because you were busy. It's because you made different choices. So that's one thing about really owning your own life. Time is so incredibly fair. We all get 24/7. So there's no one accomplishing more with a different construct of time. The theory of relativity will tell you something otherwise, but for your practical purposes, you can assume it's a constant, right? So just go ahead with the notion that for you, it's a constant in getting stuff done. So you have to recognize that you got to say, what do I want to accomplish?
What are just the few linchpin things that matter in that happening? What are the highest value activities that I can do now in order to make that true? So I give a lot of tactical frameworks in the book for how to actually think through what are my priorities, what do I do, what do I get other people to do? But it has to start with accepting time truths, which is one, time is very fair. We all have the same time. And the what you produce is really the just an outcome of how you choose to use it. And then how efficient you are, you know, during that time. So my, if I think of all the things you can do in 24 hours a day, the other thing I really talk about is you can't tell yourself that you have an endless amount of time to work and that's how you create great. I found that in my first career, I worked all the time. And I was actually a terrible leader because I was exhausted. I was depleted. I was less creative. I was less strategic because I was young and naive. And I thought that the way to signal that my commitment to my employees and to my investors was literally to work all the time. I ate every meal at my desk. I worked every night and weekend. And I just would go harder and drive harder. And that would be my approach.
Yeah.
And with having a family doing my second business, I became so much more efficient because I had to walk out that door at 4:45, or literally Charlie would be unattended. The nanny would leave and there would be no one caring for my kids. So I had to go. So then that made me say, all right, what do I need to get done? What's going to have to, and so the thing I always think about is we're all juggling. And if you're a creative, ambitious person, there's going to be more on your to-do list than you're ever going to do. You're going to die with things on the list. Just make you leave the right things undone. And so which balls are rubber and which balls are glass in the juggling act? You let the rubber ones bounce, but you keep the glass ones in the air. And your family is a glass ball. Your personal health and wellness is a glass ball. And then there's a few things in your business that are glass balls. Most everything else is rubber. And so when you can identify what they are, I am far more productive when I sleep 7 hours a night, when I exercise every day, and when I eat healthy. So to tell yourself you don't have time for those things, I don't have time not to do them because I get back such higher quality time and so much more energy later.
This plays into risk. And hear me out. So I think that someone who just got a round of funding or a new entrepreneur would say, I can't afford to see how that plays out. I'm going to have to do this. I got to play it this way because this is how it's done. I'm curious to know, and I felt for me personally that having a family while I was building my business was actually a good thing for the very reasons you described, because it made me more productive. I actually had my business partner once said to me, I actually worry about you because you don't have kids. Because you have there's no boundary.
There's no stop time.
Right. And I said, but you don't have kids. So what are you telling? It was just an interesting comment given she had no kids. I said, so you have boundaries? She says, yeah. But I think that sometimes you are forced to have those thoughts and those boundaries. But also for me, the concept of risk was different. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I felt like I had nothing to lose without not having the family. And then when I did, I felt like I did have something to lose, but I also felt like that meant I needed to do something super important. I couldn't risk not doing something that was so critical to my happiness, to my sense of accomplishment, of meaning. So I wondered if you had a similar take on that, and how did that change for you between the two businesses, the one before kids and the one after?
Well, I'm a risk lover. I'm a calculated risk lover. And I think most entrepreneurs are that the mindset of, because I always want to, I look around the world and I see the way I want things to be instead of the way that they are. Mm-hmm. And I'm just calculating, well, if I could take what I got and trade it in for that, you know, is that better? Let me assess the odds of that happening. And so I love risk. I think that, it's really about not being just a risk-loving maverick. It's about being a calculated risk-loving maverick where you're constantly assessing and calibrating and analyzing and playing the game theory about what the right choice is. I think that's one of the most fun parts of business. But to me, the family thing is super cut and dry. I mean, there's really not a lot to think about or discuss there. It's that you have to be present and have quality time with your family or you're going to miss out on too much and you'll regret it. And so, I mean, I have a very opinionated and strong husband on that topic, and kids that are like watchdogs if I ever touch my phone. So it's very helpful. You know, we spend a lot of great quality time together. We have dinner together every night, right? So I travel, but not that much anymore. I really had to get that under control. Yeah. I put really hard boundaries around the amount that I was traveling because I was wearing myself down, and I found that I was always sick and I wasn't my best self when I was home with my family, and they don't deserve to have the husk of a human me. They deserve to have the best version of me. So, but I don't know how to think about that differently in terms of risk. I mean, to me, I would never gamble with that. Business is in a different zone, but here that is 100% protected sanctuary.
And I think, I guess where I'm going with that is, did that change for you? Because I think that, first round of funding, no family, I'll do whatever you ask. It completely changed. That equation completely changed. And I still felt it was still doable for me. But it's a different mindset.
I'm not averse to failure. So risk doesn't seem that bad to me. You know, I honestly think that it goes back to that story of when I applied to community college and she told me not to apply. And I thought to myself, do I want to be the person that applied and didn't get in and wasted a little time? Mm-hmm. Or do I want to be the person that didn't even try? I'd much rather be the first type of failure than, because to me, the latter is far worse. So I really do think that I'm unattached. I've sort of, it's very Zen Buddha of me, but I don't really think that the outcome, the worst case scenario of failure is really that bad. You know, if I have my family and I have my health, I mean, my husband and I are educated, we're capable people, we could go get a different job, you know, so I don't need feel like those having particular things or a particular title or a particular, it goes back to, again, thinking with a lone eagle mindset. Like, am I really looking for the world to deem that I'm successful or that this is worth it? Or am I internally saying, that's okay, well, it's good, get better next time? And I think I really probably have that perspective on risk from my dad.
Yeah.
You know, his mother was educated to the fourth grade in Italy and then had to stop going to school because she was taking care of her younger siblings while her dad was a prisoner of war. And it was with a sickly stepmother who was not kind to her and never gave her milk, and she had rickets and a deformed every bone in her body. She finally gets back to America where she was actually born, but where she went back when she was 4 years old because her mother and sister had died. She went back to Italy, then came back over and got in right before Mussolini closed the borders. She worked in a factory for 8 years to pay back her passage before she met a man, my grandfather, and had two sons, and they were one and three, and he died from appendicitis, of all things. Right? You wouldn't die of that today. But she became a widow, not educated, in a country in the middle of a banking crisis, 16% unemployment at the end of the Great Depression. And she had to survive. She took in boarders to their house. She stuffed jelly into donuts at night. She sewed all their clothing. And my father grew up, and he had a paper route when he was in the fourth grade to help put food on the table. And so his mentality growing up was, first of all, he went to school down the street, and his recollection of his youth was, aren't I lucky? You know, the nuns would compliment him on how pressed his homemade clothes were. And he remembers the delicious bread that my grandmother baked for him. You know, she was trying to save money with a bag of flour, but he remembers the love and the handmade bread and how wonderful it was. And then when he was in high school, he never thought that he'd be able to afford to go to college because he had to pay for his mom and sister. But he was going to fail trigonometry. And the teacher said, listen, if you don't pass this class, you know, calculus is next. And if you think this was hard, wait till you get calculus. And he thought, oh my God, wait a minute. I could not graduate high school, and I'm going to have to go home and tell my mom I'm not going to be the first person in my family to graduate high school. I better crack a book. So he went to the library and he taught himself calculus. And according to him, he comes back and he could have taught the class, and he was much better than the professor. But then he kept going and he kept teaching himself. And he went and ultimately, you know, got his master's degree in engineering, and he put himself through school. And he never had this sense that I could fail. He changed his career many times over. He was an engineer. He built homes. Then the housing crisis came and interest rates went up to 20%, right? Right now, prime is almost zero, right? So it's like 3% you'd pay for a mortgage. It was 20. It shut down the housing market overnight. He just said, well, so what? Tough luck. Big deal. Go do something else. And he'd read some more books, and then he'd teach himself a new career. So I think from him growing up, seeing him change his career, I think I've learned that failure and risk is a part of success. It's a necessary person. Now you have to then combine that with a lot of hard work and a lot of resilience and a lot of intensity and a lot of passion. Yeah. But you ultimately have to embrace that fear and failure is the only way that extraordinary is made real.
Just wanted to call out, if anyone has questions, we can now take them. So please. Oh, well, can we take them now? Okay, great. Oh, okay. She doesn't have a question, but please, if you do have a question, we will be taking some questions. So I have to ask, what does your father think about business?
He loves this business. He's very proud. He loves the book because he's in it. So he thinks that's great. And as I say, you know, he's always given me, he never told me that I was doing something great if I wasn't. You know, when I graduated from high school, there were no presents or parties. It's like, oh, any kid who can fog a mirror can graduate high school. You know, like, so what? Like, you know, so he was never overly impressed, but he's very proud now. And I knew someone would buy a copy of the book for sure. It's my dad. But he's such a curious mind. You know, he's 78 and is, curious about learning something new, as he has always been. He's been a phenomenal role model. I also do think there's a gift about being raised by a single dad, and having the challenges of a childhood with having a mentally ill parent. Is it makes you so strong, because these things that a lot of you take for granted, right? The love of a mother is supposed to be an inalienable right. And if yours is not capable of that, you realize you're like, actually, I'm still kicking over here. I'm surviving. And so I can keep going. And so other problems just seem really small.
It also seems that if there's something that I see in you, that when you describe your father, it's you always will invent a possibility out of whatever comes up.
Well, I've learned to find the gift in any difficult situation, because if you look for it, there is one. And I know that sounds ridiculous. And sometimes people think, God, sometimes I'm so positive I annoy myself. But I've really come to see there's just nothing positive about being negative and nothing negative about being positive. And it's really working out. So I'm going to keep going with this strategy.
So you've taken the business quite a ways. How do you keep it fresh? How do you say, okay, now what's next?
We are inherently dissatisfied, and we're just beginning. We're just having coffee, our first cup of coffee in the morning, with what we're going to do to change the world with the Stella Dot family brands. I'm 100% sure, with every bone in my body.
And just by being in that mindset, there's always going to be something else.
That's right.
So, question.
I don't know how to follow that question, but Jessica, big fan of yours. My third company, which I sold, was modeled after yours. But, you know, I think you're brilliant.
Thank you.
Getting to my question, what business do you wish you could start if you weren't doing Selling Dot?
I would just start another one within Selling Dot, which would become Keep Collective and Ever Skincare. I really wanted to create a platform so that the entrepreneur in me would always have an outlet for that, because it is something that I need to do and need to nourish. I actually love growing a scaling business, but I also love invention. So that really works out that way. And it's also the way that we would make the most impact on people, which is so core to my mission. You know, I'm so in love with this business and our mission. It's hard for me to answer the questions like, well, who would you marry if you didn't love your husband? I kind of feel dirty answering the question.
Huh.
Like, I have other passions, but they do. You know, I studied economics, and I probably would teach economics. You know, I really love job creation. I really believe in. It's why I love our mission. And again, I think I've shared a lot around the experience of growing up with someone who didn't feel they had economic freedom or choices has made me just so focused on how much that does for life and the people around them, that if you can create more economic opportunity and choices. So I would do something in either an education or public service, but from a business perspective, this is it.
That's the thread. Regardless of what the product is behind it to get them there, it seems like that is the thread of choice.
Enabling choice and independence for people is what I love doing. Yeah.
Yes.
I am half Italian, as if you couldn't tell, and half Ukrainian. But I very much look like the Italian side.
It shows.
Which part? The over gesticulation with the hands?
I'm also half Italian, by the way. And I have a sister named Julie.
Oh.
So we have so much in common. And we're Jays. Yeah.
Is your sister Julie?
Yes, she is.
Yes, her sister in the book.
I'm Julie, too.
Hello. Oh, hi, Julie.
We love that Julie's was weird. Around here. Okay.
So I was inspired when I saw that you were speaking, and I started my first business when I was very young. And I was curious about your beginning, and I apologize, you may have covered this, and I came in late. Did you have a moment in your young years where you knew that your path was to be an entrepreneur?
I think I've always known that. I've always wanted to do it since my first job at the mall, scooping ice cream in Baskin Robbins, or, you know, and then I work at a clothes store. I always, you know, I'm looking at a process or an operations, and I instantly want to improve it. I'm like, you know, what would really be good? We could serve twice the customers and, you know, in half the time if we reconfigured this line. And how, you know, so I think in my instinct of one, I like to be in control of my own destiny, and entrepreneurship allows you that. And I have a lot of ideas and imagination, and it's, I think, yeah, I was born to be an entrepreneur. I did not pick it. It picked me for sure.
That's great. I'd like to explore teaching younger kids how to be an entrepreneur. And I know that there are programs in this country, but I was curious, have you ever looked into that, or have you supported that, or what's your viewpoint?
Yes.
How young would you go? It's called
Stella & Family of Brands, because you put business inside the home. And you got to show them, don't tell them. Being an entrepreneur is about resilience. It's about goal setting. It's about learning. It's about believing. And honestly, it's one of the most beautiful byproducts of our business, that I think the utility that we create that way is awesome. I can proudly say, which is, I am their mother, so I may be slightly biased, but I'm amazed at the business acumen of my children. And it's just because we've been talking about it around the business table literally since they were born. So I think that and our business is very understandable. So I think that's one I love, is just the show them, don't tell them approach, and make businesses accessible. But we've worked with other groups that Stella & Dot Foundation has funded, like Girls Inc., and they do have practical application courses and things like that that are, and it's also just general skills, right? Math, science, English, other things where they're bolstering and getting help. But I did want to write the book for a broader audience, and it was very important to me that the voice feel very accessible. It's interesting. So, meaning I recommend that people as young as 12 read it, because I think it has a lot in there about how you become an entrepreneur. How do you do it? How do you learn? You do, because it's always the doing that's the difference.
Thank you.
Seems to hear, though, that you also address in the book, of course, you can learn to code, you can learn finance, you can learn all of the skills, but the confidence thing, it's about enabling kids to also just go for it.
Well, it's the embracing of failure and learning to look inward for approval versus constantly validating your choices by others.
Hi. So actually, my question goes off of that one really well. I'm a college student. I was wondering if you had any advice for kind of determining if you wanted to become an entrepreneur, what kind of how you choose the path that you want to take, what kind of business you want to go into. What's your advice?
I am so glad you asked. Work hard and pay your dues. You have got to go into every job, and this is as if opportunity is dangling from the chandeliers. And if you go in there and you bring it and you do your best and you feel lucky to get any job and any paycheck, and you will look at it with a lens that lets you then find the opportunity, because you're assuming this is part of your career building skills that will then make you the person that's ready to find that passion and then capable of starting and growing that business. So don't think that there's some kind of fork in the road in which you say, I'm either an entrepreneur or I'm not. I take this corporate job or I don't. What it takes is constantly being on a quest of adding value and self-improvement, and then curiosity and wonder around what impact do you want to make on the world? What cause do you care so much about that you want to bound every bed out of bed in the morning and work as hard as it truly takes to be an entrepreneur? Being an entrepreneur is not for the faint of heart. And it takes longer than you think, and it's harder than you think. So you got to be picking a business that you care so much about, you have to make it real. So when I think about my first job out of college, it was in an enterprise software company. And I know this is the least sexy thing I could possibly say. We were aggregating price and availability of data for computer parts. But if you think about what Wedding Channel does, it aggregates price and availability of gift registries. And that's where I got the idea. But if I had gone into that job with
with the attitude of, I don't want to work hard because there's not enough in it for me or this, and I would have missed that. So I think that my biggest message to college students and young graduates is pursue a path of passion, but pursue a path of hard work. Never be afraid to wash windows. Never be afraid to show up, show up, show up, and feel lucky to be there.
Thank you.
Right. Hi, on. Thanks yes. so much for sharing your experience. I just had a question. Were you ever overwhelmed by your passion to start something? And then how did you temper that so that you could actually be productive?
So overwhelmed is another one of those words that's on my no-no list and of the with crazy busy. So whenever you're feeling overwhelmed, I like to recast that thought as I have some prioritizations to do and choices to make. Now, there's a grace period around delivery of birth and newbornhood in which you can just go ahead and cry and be overwhelmed at all times. But aside from that window, overwhelmed by my passion, yes, I am overwhelmed by my passion every day. If in terms of being like consumed in a really positive and good way, I live that way on a daily basis. Like, I'm so excited every day to go do what I want to do. And so I think you want to give in to the good stuff, but resist the other form.
Great, thanks.
Time for one more.
Hi there. Thank you so much for coming today. I've just gained so much from your wisdom, and you're clearly so intelligent and successful. So I'm curious who your mentors are, and if there are any, like, I don't know, Twitters or Facebooks that you regularly follow and check or, like, live by any certain mantras that had led to you to where you are today.
So my greatest mentor is my father, and I've learned a lot from our amazing board of directors, my board members, that have taught me a lot about business and life along the way. And when I think about where I learn from reading, I'm a voracious reader. A lot of it is resurfacing it in the forefront of my mind. But I like a lot of the classics, like Michael Porter and even Jim Collins, more current, but really just core business principle things. And then reading, I just picked up Clara Shih's new book on the social imperative of business. So I read a lot and I try to learn a lot. I feel like a lifelong student. But I think the biggest thing that is my advice that I've learned from a mentor that Leslie knows well is Doug McKenzie has been on my board with both companies. I've known him in business for almost 20 years. And when we first got funding, he taught me a lesson, which was we were going to raise $1 million. We'd only got the first 300 unless we signed up Macy's. And then we had the summer to close that deal, and then we'd get the next 700. And we'd be in business for good, in my mind. And we were going and doing all this stuff. And we were building prototypes. We were getting engineers on board. We were doing all the things you need to do to start a business. But every time I'd go in and talk to him, I'd be like, we got the logo and the branding is done. The website is up. And he's like, that's great. Did you sign up Macy's? Like, no. But we went and got Crate and Barrel and we got Williams Sonoma and we got all these things. And if you aggregate them together, they're actually larger than Macy's. He's like, that's great. Did you sign up Macy's? And I'm like, and eventually, oh, I see. This is the 800-pound grill. You have to sign up Macy's. So the best advice I've ever gotten is the ability to ask the right question. You can be very busy and answering the wrong question, solving the wrong problem. So you have to understand in your career, in life, what is your equivalent to signing up Macy's? And are you procrastinating by not going and doing these things and accomplishing all these things on the list but not really doing it? So I would say that's still a great source of advice for me, but something I've learned from a mentor along the way.
Okay, do we have one more question?
We do.
We have one more question.
Although I feel like we could listen to you talk all night, Jessica. This is really amazing. Thank you. So my question goes back to your really inspiring comments about balance and the choices that you make to find those. But I'm feeling like in this day and age, the challenge is not, finding work-life balance. It's finding balance between your digital life
yes.
and your face-to-face life with the people that you know and love and care about and the people that you need to attract. So I'm hoping you might be able to share some tips or resources that you rely on that help you to filter and be efficient at getting the message out there in your social media life and
yes.
PR and all that.
So, boundaries are really important, right? There cannot be a digital device at the dinner table. That is a time for eyeball-to-eyeball QT. And you shouldn't be, I really do think it's like living in the dystopia of Fahrenheit 451, where your brain gets scrambled all the time by the constant hit of the data crack. And there's been studies done that your productivity absolutely drops because you're paying the switching costs and it's winding down the battery of your brain. And people think far more about recharging their device than they do their own mind. And that is no way to be extraordinary. You will be frazzled and exhausted if you are constantly checking that. So I'm very disciplined around the task. So I check social media during particular times, but I will time block so that when I want to go work on this financial model or work on this branding problem, I will focus on that and not go divert and do other things. I let the phone go to voicemail unless it's one of my children, and they always call back 5 times if they really need me. But other than that, I'm very disciplined about the practice, and it's really hard, right? It's addictive to go do these things. So it's about constantly reminding yourself to not always be on your phone and actually be present in the moment that you're in. And I have I describe in the book what I've done that really helps me, which is a disciplined practice of meditation, which, by the way, I would have thought was very touchy-feely, you know, flies landing on my face, monks, incense, sitting cross-legged, not for me as a super active person, but I do it by going through thoughts in my head while I run and unplugging at certain times and really learning how much happier and more vibrant I feel when I disconnect. So I'm incredibly rigorous about disconnecting.
So, okay. In the tradition of Inforum, Jessica, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask for, in 60 seconds, your idea to change the world.
That was, you told me you were going to ask that, so I should have known my 60-second answer. Well, you know, I would do so many things to change the world. I think the first thing I would do, if I had a magic wand, right, this is a magic wand type of thing, I would have people go about their day with no fear that their gender or their color or their age or their background has any influence on their future.
It's pretty radical. So we are wrapping up, and I know there are a couple housekeeping notes. Would you care? Oh, and I guess I'm going to read them to you. So first of all, thank you for coming, and we're looking forward to joining you all for some wine in the other room and in the fireside room and for Jessica's book signing. And I believe it's just right in the fireside room. So thank you again for coming, and we'll see you just next door. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Thank you.